It's great to be sitting here together again, another Wednesday evening, hump day. The mind gets rolling, in the week, find ourselves maybe quite project-oriented, and then show up here together Wednesday evenings and just settle in. And I don't know about you, but for me, it's almost funny. I sit every night, but there is some power to sitting with others that I can't explain. But the stillness of sitting with all of you, just being present together, really, this evening anyway, illuminated for me how busy my mind is. Was as we began sitting together. And not a problem, not really an issue or a problem, but just noticing and kind of sinking into the body of practice, sinking into the aliveness of sensation and the physical self, the breathing, arriving is so lovely. It's lovely to allow ourselves to do this together. And I really feel the support of our Sangha. I really appreciate it. So one of the things I was doing with my active mind as I began sitting was thinking about this talk. And there's been a phrase that's with me. It's actually from a blog post that I wrote. I usually don't cite myself in Dharma talks. But this little phrase is, enlightenment is not enough. And I thought I'd like to just explore that a little bit with you. I love the chants that we did tonight. Actually, believe it or not, they were perfectly attuned toward the talk. The first one, self and other the same. When we read it, it's just, it is really talking about a kind of awakening, a realization of our true nature. And sometimes the word enlightenment is used to describe this. Enlightenment is actually a little bit of a mistranslation of the term, the original term, bodhi, having more to do with awakening than enlightenment. And we have a kind of culture and set of ideas around enlightenment that make it sound so dramatic and incredible that when someone is enlightened, that this must be this remarkable transformation of consciousness. And I guess, when we read the chants and really enter into them, they're just pointing us toward what we already are. It is not that we discover some second, more profound layer of consciousness that we didn't know about before. And I think that sometimes this idea of enlightenment can be so mysterious that we might imagine that we are definitely not it. I think that that can then prevent us from having kind of faith. That what we are experiencing is actually it. So we can find ourselves looking outside of our experience for something else. So these chants are so lovely because what they're doing is illuminating for us how our experience already matches these descriptions. Self and other are already the same. Everything is part of you. You are part of everything. We are like leaves growing on the tree of the world. We're born out of the air and the earth. We manifest like the flowers of spring, and we die right back into the earth whence we came. We are not separate. And this is not just an intellectual idea, it's just true. We are breathing this air, and is it me, is it not me? We create these ideas of self and other that confuse us. And so meditation is just about kind of sinking beneath the level of these confusing ideas. Letting ourselves observe our actual experience, that's all. And when we observe our actual experience, we gain some clarity about how intimate everything is, about how interwoven everything is. And the sense of non-separation is just evident. So this does not erase our thinking selves. They go on. And we also can see the world as separate, you, me. But on some level, that's also not true. And the human mind doesn't like contradiction. So we want to settle the matter once and for all and just slip into one side of the equation. If I could just always be feeling the unity of things, life would be okay. But really, the unity of things is something that we can just have faith in. It's just always true. And without it, we would not exist. It is actually our nature. We are always breathing the air that is in and outside of us, always hearing the sounds that are in and outside of us, thinking with a language we did not even create. So we are interwoven very deeply, and we can see this, and it can be quite a dramatic feeling to notice this, to feel like things are moving through our own hearts. Sometimes we call it compassion, sometimes awakening, but a sense of a big interconnectedness. So one might imagine, oh, you know, once I get that, once I really, really understand that or feel that, then I will be saved and all beings will be saved. And so we kind of aim toward something, of course, which we already are. Imagining that if we can attain it, then there is total liberation and nothing left to worry about. And this is not true. It is a beautiful, lovely, it can make you cry to really feel how interwoven we are, how we are one, and how even the one is empty. Beautiful and still, not enough. Enlightenment is not enough. There is still work to do. There is the work that we have to do with ourselves and for ourselves. This work is what we might call self-care, the work of eating when we are hungry, sleeping when we are tired, the work of preparing the meal, the work of taking care of our physical and mental health, whatever forms that may take, taking medication, seeing the doctor, seeing a therapist, all of the things that we may need to do to take care of ourselves. Enlightenment does not feed you. Enlightenment And enlightenment does not feed the world. There are many, many beings who are hungry. Our culture rife with systemic racism, misogyny. Our world filled with plastic everywhere, filling the oceans, creatures dying from swallowing too much plastic, whales filled with 80 pounds of plastic dying. Our air filled with the smog causing global warming. Species going extinct at a rate almost never seen before. Entire ecosystem at risk. Of course, we have to take care. Well, we don't have to. We cannot take care. And people will suffer. Our own awakening doesn't do a thing for the hungry child. It doesn't do a thing for the whale who has just died or is choking. There's work to be done in this world. I think that sometimes what can happen is we can slip into that either-or mind. Either I will focus on my practice, or I will focus on accomplishing goals. But the two cannot be one. And I think that's also a mistake. I think Zen practice can include all of these things. Zen practice includes our realizing that even these vicissitudes of life are the terrain of enlightenment. That our work in the world with ourselves, this is the work of skillful means. And this is really important work to be done. This engagement, this taking care of self and other. And there really is great comfort in the practice of waking up. We can find that so many levels of suffering are extra, built on the feeding of our conceptions of duality that cause us a lot of pain. And we don't have to hold on to those quite so tight. There is something more for us. Even with all this work to do, there is still this breath. The beauty of this breath and the way it nourishes and penetrates us. These two sides of practice, which you might think of as acceptance and changing the things that we can, are complementary. They go hand in hand. We don't have to choose one or the other. We can actually accept that there are things to change. And really practice in the midst of that work. And practicing here on the cushion is part of our deepening of our quite remarkable capacity to be with things just as they are, even the things that are difficult, even the things that need to be changed. We are deepening our capacity to be with things as they are. This deepens our equanimity, our capacity for the work that we do in the world. So these two sides of a coin. So you know, the basic idea that, that Zen is not just sitting. And yet the sitting is so, so important. Without it, we can just get lost in our notions about the world. The inner and outer work, not separate.